celebrating Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary. Tune in tomorrow to Democracy Now! When we air an historic conversation between Noam Chomsky and Harry Belafonte. Never before together in conversation at a public event. And that's what we did with them last night. You can also watch the full 2.5-hour event, the celebration of Democracy Now!, at democracynow.org. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Aaron Dooley, Hugh Grand, David Prude, R.L. Boone, Vesta Godarz. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO Benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue in Portland. KBOO and Elysian Brewing will celebrate the release of the Manic IPA series with hip-hop, funk, and electronica spun by The Pariahs, DJ Dakimba, and Vinology. Again, that's Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO Benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue, 3341 Southeast Belmont Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Hay Fever, produced by the Portland Actors Conservatory and running from December 2nd to December 18th. In Hay Fever, the Bliss family have all invited house guests for the weekend. Artistic eccentricity and flirtation are misinterpreted and hilarity ensues. Again, that's Hay Fever, produced by the Portland Actors Conservatory and running December 2nd to December 18th. The play takes place at 1436 Southwest Magoo Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And the time is now 5:01 p.m. That means it's time for your volunteer-produced evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, election recounts move forward in four states.
Local organization BARC talks about their recent success in ground truthing along the Molalla River.
And live in Studio 2, we interview Hillary Shahoney from Pacific Rivers to talk about dam removal along the Lower Snake River.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News Hour for Tuesday, December 6th, 2016. I'm Joe Lino.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. At this time, four states are currently involved in recounts of last month's presidential election. In Wisconsin, a federal judge has denied a lawsuit filed by a Trump supporter and two super PACs seeking to halt the recount, which began on Thursday and continued over the weekend. State election officials do not expect the results to show Hillary Clinton to surpass Trump's lead of about 22,000 votes. A federal judge in Michigan ordered a hand recount to begin no later than noon on Monday, where Trump defeated Clinton by only 0.2 percentage point. The Trump campaign and super PACs have filed separate lawsuits asking to stop the recount, arguing that Jill Stein, as the fourth place finisher, could not be considered as, quote, aggrieved. Pennsylvania shows Trump's lead to be shrinking by about 20,000 votes out of the more than 6 million cast. A recount of sample ballots has begun in Nevada, which is anticipated to be completed by Friday. If the samples from Carson City and three other counties show more than a 1% discrepancy, a full recount will be launched in all of 17 of Nevada's counties. Clinton won the state by over 27,000 votes.
Hearings over the killing of Larnell Bruce began yesterday. The video related to the August death of Bruce in Gresham was shown by a Multnomah County prosecutor at Monday's hearing. Surveillance footage from a Gresham 7-Eleven shows Bruce running to get away from the Jeep that struck and killed him. Defendant Colleen Catherine Hunt is one of the two people facing charges for murder in Bruce's death, as well as first and second degree intimidation, which are hate crimes. She had asked to be released from jail pending trial in August 2017. In addition to the video, prosecutor David Hannon shared eyewitness statements that Hunt shouted, quote, "Run him over," moments before co-defendant Russell Orlando Cartier is alleged to have done just that. Hunt will remain in jail following a determination from the court that there is a strong presumption she is an accomplice to murder. Cartier did not file a request to be released before the trial and will also remain in jail.
The Washington County Sheriff's Office has issued a warrant for the arrest of a local man convicted last week on charges of revenge porn or unlawful dissemination of an intimate image. Benjamin Barber had been ordered to appear at the Washington County Jail by 7 p.m. on Friday to begin serving a six-month sentence. The case is noteworthy because it's the first conviction for the county under a new Oregon law meant to protect people from the abusive practice of publishing explicit photos of them on the internet without consent. 34 states and the District of Columbia have passed laws against revenge porn. Barber uploaded four videos of himself and a former partner to several websites. He was found guilty of the charges by a jury in November. The conditions of his sentence also restricts him from using computers and the internet outside of work and require him to avoid contact with the woman and destroy any images of her in his possession. Barber has said he plans to sue the state of Oregon for what he claims is a violation of his First Amendment rights, stating that he is allowed to post the videos legally because he holds the copyright and that the woman involved has no right to privacy. Barber has previously filed in small claims courts against local organizations for women working in technology, saying that their practices are also a violation of his rights.
Last year, the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, proposed a 440-acre timber sale encompassing the upper Molalla River. Yesterday, BARC, the local watchdog organization for Mount Hood National Forest, announced that the BLM has decided to remove 88 acres from the sale. The sale is titled the Hole in the Road Timber Management Project, or HITR. The acres removed are within areas BARC put through a research process they call ground truthing. BARC is pleased the BLM removed areas from the sale they voiced concerns about over a year ago. However, they are quick to point out that the public has only until December 29th to comment on the remaining 352 acres proposed for logging. For more on the story, I interviewed BARC spokesperson Michael Carocta. The BLM just dropped 88 acres from a proposed 440-acre timber sale. What kind of involvement did BARC have in this decision?
Well, so BARC, as an organization, as many folks know, we monitor forests surrounding Mount Hood and mostly Forest Service land, but also BLM land like that along the Molalla River. We got a letter notifying us last year of this timber sale proposal along the Molalla River, and we got volunteers out on the ground to do something called ground truthing, which is something that we do as an organization. We go out with maps and planning documents in hand, walk areas that, in this case, the BLM is proposing to log, and compare what we see on the ground to what the planning documents and maps actually say. Many times those two things are quite different. And so when we went out, we noticed that a lot of the proposed treatment areas or units had a lot of old-growth trees in them. They had really sensitive riparian areas or mountain streams. And we submitted comments for a 30-day comment period that was held last fall. And we just received a notification that several of the areas that we submitted comments on and had concerns about were actually dropped by the BLM, which is very good news to us. So that's been our involvement thus far in this project.
So what were some of BARC's major concerns about the areas that were dropped and that are still proposed for the timber sale?
Right. So some of our biggest concerns that we had initially with this project Well, it was a number of things. One of the things was that we expected that the BLM was going to be targeting younger forests, but when we went out, we ended up seeing that several of these stands of trees were really quite old, at least 150 years old, and some of them actually had even older trees within the unit. And lots of times, those units were actually completely surrounded by clear cuts, and so it really heightened the value of the habitat that existed in these units that were left, and those were the areas that the BLM was targeting. And so we had concerns about old-growth trees, also logging in riparian areas or wet areas up in higher elevation mountain streams, which is also really important habitat to maintain and keep connected, especially in regards to some of the projected effects of climate change on forests that we're just now learning about. So those were probably two of the biggest things. We are still concerned that there are forests that they are targeting that are upwards of nearly 150 years old. As far as we know, have no history of logging. And there's also forests that are within what the BLM is calling a suitable wild and scenic river, that being the Malala River, a suitable wild and scenic corridor, which they've actually said possesses, you know, outstandingly remarkable scenic, recreational, geologic, fish and wildlife, historic, cultural, and other values. So many, many values that exist there that if are commercially logged might lose some of those values and be less eligible for designation if we ever get a Congress that is going to be a little more friendly to increasing environmental protections on our waterways here in Oregon.
What do people need to know about the remaining public comment period about the 350 acres up for possible sale that still remain in the HITR?
So the remaining acres with this timber sale are up for comments. It's a 30-day comment period that started late last week, and so the deadline for that comment period is December 29th. So not great timing in terms of the holidays, but we're kind of used to that by now. People can submit their written comments or email comments to the BLM, and we have information about how to do that on our website, bark-out.org. And so you can check that website, or you can give us a call at 503-331-0374 if you want to learn more about this or any other timber sale that's being proposed around Mount Hood right now.
Michael, can't thank you enough. Appreciate you taking the time for this interview.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Joe Lino with KBOO News.
Native lands continue to be at risk. Two Utah congressmen, Rob Bishop and Jason Shavitz, have introduced a bill in the House of Representatives that would result in the largest assault on Native lands in the last 100 years. The bill proposes to take 100,000 acres of the Ute tribal land and turn them over to oil and mining interest. It will also remove protection from 18 million acres of land in eastern Utah and prevent the Bears Ears area from being designated as a national monument. Southwestern Native tribes have been inhabiting this land for over 11,000 years, with the White Mesa Ute Reservation bordering the Bears Ears area. Mineral and oil companies are now looking at this area as it's rich in oil deposits of uranium and potash and has the presence of tar sands oil. Although the bill will not be presented to Congress for a few more weeks, the Ute Business Committee is already preparing for a fight. In an op-ed piece the committee wrote for the Salt Lake Tribune, they said, quote, "This proposal runs the risk of returning to failed policies of tribal land dispossession that have had a devastating and lasting impact upon tribal nations for the past century."
Next week, 9 Iowa landowners will be in court to challenge the use of eminent domain law after they refused to sell their land for the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Sunday's announcement that the Army Corps of Engineers would deny a needed easement permit for the pipeline has many wondering about how it could impact other challenges. If completed, the pipeline will cross over 1,000 miles through 4 states, including Iowa and Illinois. Eminent domain allows the state to take private lands for public use. In the case of the pipeline project, the project was declared a public utility. Even if permits to construct the pipeline are denied, the land that was taken continues to be owned by the state. The use of eminent domain for private companies' use was established by a 2005 Supreme Court ruling. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of calling private development plans focused on economic growth a public use. The landowner's suit in Iowa challenges the state of Iowa's categorizing of the pipeline project as a public utility. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke to Ed Fallon of advocacy organization Iowa Bold this morning on Air Cascadia about the impact of Sunday's victory at Standing Rock.
Well, and I just got back from Standing Rock. I was there for a week. I arrived just in time for the first blizzard, and that was a three-day event. I see there's another one going on now. as cold as it gets in Iowa, they get it worse up there in North Dakota. So I have great admiration for their perseverance. And yes, the victory occurred just as I'm leaving the camp, and it was amazing to hear that. It is a huge victory for Standing Rock, although it's not in the bag. We don't know for sure what the Trump administration is going to do. Now Dakota Access is also talking as if they're going to continue to push ahead with construction. How it affects Iowa is an even bigger question. It's certainly a huge step forward. I compare it to scoring the go-ahead touchdown with just a little bit of time left in the game. You know, we've got the advantage now, and we have to keep pushing. But we're not quite sure how it's all going to turn out. We got to pretend that we got to act like this is still anybody's. You know, the outcome could be anything at all. So in Iowa, we have the big thing here is the landowner's lawsuit that's coming up on December 15th. These are the nine landowners, nine out of about 300 who were opposed to eminent domain, nine who have gone to the extreme measure of spending a bunch of money on legal fees and putting in lots of time and effort to take the case to court. That court hearing is on December 15th, and we're expecting a big crowd to stand in support with them, and also to make clear that this is about eminent domain and the right to have access to your property without a private company taking it over. But we're also concerned about water quality, about climate, about native rights and native land treaties. So it'll be a significant event. How the decision by the Corps affects it, I'm not quite sure. But again, we're very encouraged here, and we're going to just keep pushing as hard as we can and hope that the issues we're fighting on here receive the same kind of consideration from the federal government as the concerns that have been raised by our native allies.
And how does this case coming up on the 15th, how does this affect the whole architecture of eminent domain?
Well, it is a huge issue beyond the pipeline because it all dates back to a significant national eminent domain case involving a family by the name of Kelo versus New London, Connecticut, in which the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the landowner in favor of the corporation. And that spawned a whole chain reaction of legislative initiatives across the country where states were toughening their eminent domain laws. And Iowa was one of those states. And we thought it was pretty clear the way the law was written, you could not use eminent domain for a private company. Yet the pipeline company has found, well, they basically created, with the help of money, money buying off our political establishment, they found a way to create a loophole that describes them as a public utility, even though they're not providing any services to anybody in our state or anywhere along the pipeline route.
A public utility. I cannot imagine any basis or standing. How could this possibly have standing in any court anywhere?
Well, we think we have a pretty strong case, so we're cautiously optimistic about how this is going to move forward. But, again, you never can tell. And if the court does rule in our favor, and if it doesn't happen at the district court level, we will appeal, and it will go to the Supreme Court, the Iowa Supreme Court. And if they rule in our favor, the option, it's hard to know what the options are going to be. The court will make that determination. They could require the company to pull the pipe out of the ground. They could, at a minimum, require lots of compensation for damages and court costs and loss of yields of crops and soil damage. There's lots of possibilities in terms of how they might, decide what would be the appropriate response. But we're a ways off from that. We'll see what happens in district court, but we're fully prepared to take it to the next level if needed.
That was Chris Andre speaking with Ed Fallon on KBOO's Air Cascadia this morning.
It's just about 5:19. It's time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
All hail Augustus Trumpus. All hail the American Putin, whom none can criticize. All hail the all-knowing one, who reveals realities that aren't there and finds facts that mere mortals cannot detect. Once again, the amazing Donald has demonstrated his phantasmagoric power of perception, having found a new outcome in November's election that others hadn't seen. Trump has been greatly perturbed by the official results, which showed that while he won the Electoral College majority, he was not the people's choice. Instead, Hillary Clinton won the popular balloting by a margin of more than 2 million votes. Growing increasingly furious at this affront to his supernatural sense of self, the master of factual flexibility went on Twitter with an amazing revelation. "I won the popular vote," decreed our incoming tweeter-in-chief. Wow, how did he turn a 2 million vote loss into a glorious victory? "I won," he tweeted, "if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally." Wow again, millions? You'd think such a massive conspiracy with millions of illegal voters in line at thousands of precincts would have been noticed by election officials, GOP poll watchers, and the media. How did Trump find this truly incredible, quote, fact? It seems he channeled it from the mysterious tweetosphere, specifically from a Texas conspiracy hound who had earlier posted a tweet declaring, "We have verified more than 3 million votes cast by non-citizens." But this guy turns out to be part of a right-wing fringe group chasing non-existent voter frauds. Exactly none of those 3 million illegal votes have been verified. Stunned that Trump would cite his tweet as proof, he asked sheepishly, "Isn't everything on Twitter fake?" This is Jim Hightower saying, get used to it. Fakery is reality for America's next president, Augustus Trumpus.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Indiana AFL-CIO says it's cautiously optimistic about the deal struck by Trump and carrier executives to save jobs, while elated that 1,100 working people and their families know their jobs are safe this holiday season. The Indiana AFL-CIO says 1,370 people between the two plants in Huntington and Indianapolis are still losing their jobs to Mexico. And since Carrier's announcement in February that it was sending jobs to Mexico, several other Indiana plants have announced they too are shipping more American jobs to Mexico. So Indiana Organized Labor says until every working family in America feels secure knowing their job will remain in the U.S., we will expect the president-elect to uphold his campaign promise. National Nurses United in Washington, D.C. says there can be no moratorium on fixing dangerously understaffed hospitals in the nation's capital. District of Columbia's council chairman Phil Mendelson says that he will impose a 2-year moratorium on bills before the council that regulate the district's businesses. That includes legislation that would establish safe nurse-patient staffing ratios in Washington, D.C. hospitals. Union nurses say they will not accept a moratorium by elected leaders on ensuring safe care for our patients. The nurses say there will be no moratorium on nurse demands for safe patient care in hospitals. Neo-Nazi white supremacist groups are emboldened by the results of the presidential election, and that's prompting media that cover these 21st century Nazis to reevaluate how the racist groups are covered. The Associated Press just released standards for reporting on the so-called alt-right movement. That's a name that's designed to normalize the presence of neo-Nazis in America who supported Donald Trump. The Associated Press urges reporters to avoid using the alt-right name unless they provide ample context about who and what these 21st century Nazis really are. Otherwise, AP says, the media risks normalizing their extreme views to a mass audience.
brought to you by the IBEW, 725,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Brought to you by UnionJobs.com, posting jobs for unions, socially allied, and community organizations since 1997.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at TheUnionEdge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
An Oklahoma state trooper has pled guilty. Former Oklahoma state trooper Eric Roberts was sentenced to more than 8 years in prison Tuesday after pleading guilty to several charges, including indecent exposure with an adult, embezzlement, and bribery. The guilty plea was in exchange for prosecutors to drop more serious charges, which included sexual battery and rape by instrumentation, which would have resulted in a near-life sentence, as well as forcing him to register as a sex offender. Roberts had been accused of sexually assaulting three women during traffic stops. He was suspended in 2014 when a woman filed a federal lawsuit claiming he raped her following a traffic stop, which then two more women later came forward. Roberts has maintained that the sexual contact with the women was consensual. He could be released from prison in 4 years or less.
The Chinese government has so far had a restrained reaction to Donald Trump's call to Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. This was the first time an American president or president-elect has spoken directly with a Taiwanese leader since President Jimmy Carter switched diplomatic recognition to China from Taiwan. Beijing currently considers Taiwan to be a renegade province. Vice President-elect Mike Pence said on Sunday, in an attempt to play down the phone call, said it was nothing more than a courtesy call and not intended to show a shift in U.S.-China relations. The People's Daily, China's leading paper for the voice of the government, published on its front page that, quote, creating troubles for the U.S.-China relationship is creating troubles for the U.S. itself. It also remarked that, quote, this would greatly reduce the chance to achieve the goal of making America great again.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News in Depth at 5:45, followed by Transpositive at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Willamette Valley will be partly cloudy with a high of 39 and a low of 32. East of the Cascades and Hood River, skies will also be partly cloudy with a high of 36 and a low of 29. Today in history, in 1884, the Washington Monument was completed and was the world's tallest structure at the time. The quote of the day comes from Louis Farrakhan, who said, "There in the middle of this mall is the Washington Monument, 550 feet high. But if we put a 1 in front of that 555 feet, we get 1555, the year that our first fathers landed on the shores of Jamestown, Virginia as slaves." The Pacific Northwest may be famous for its wild salmon, but the number of unique species is on the decline. Since 1990, 13 stocks of salmon and steelhead of the Columbia and Snake Rivers have been added to the endangered species list. One of the biggest contributing factors to their decline are the four dams along the Snake River, which are being considered for removal. A meeting is being held tomorrow in Portland by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to take public comment. Local advocacy groups will be holding a rally and action before the meeting. Here to talk to us more about the rally and the efforts to save the wild salmon in the Snake River is Pacific Rivers Communications Director Hillary Shahoney. Hillary, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jenna. I really appreciate it.
So first, can you give us a little bit of background about the history of these dams along the Lower Snake River?
Sure. Conservation groups like mine and fishing groups, they've been fighting agency plans that have failed to protect threatened and endangered salmon for nearly two decades, a really long time. And multiple federal judges have declared that five of these plans that have been put out are illegal. And right now, we got a really big break this last May. Essentially what happened was a federal judge, Michael Simon, he rejected the idea that salmon restoration plans weren't considering dam removal as a part of the plan. And so this forced these federal plans to consider dam removal. And that's where we are today. So we have this historical opportunity where dam removal is finally being talked about. It's being considered, and we want to make sure that people know about it, and we want them to feel empowered to be a part of this change. And that's what this rally is about, is just bringing people out, giving them an opportunity to speak.
So why are removing these dams necessary? You know, we've been kind of hearing about this over the last, like, especially a couple decades. Why is removing these dams essential to the survival of wild salmon?
Yeah, so as you mentioned earlier, many of the stocks of salmon have been added to the endangered species list since the 90s. And even more salmon have, like, stocks of these salmon have gone extinct. Salmon are on the brink. These dams are impeding the migratory patterns of salmon. Young salmon need to go down the rivers. Adult salmon need to be able to swim up the rivers to get back to their spawning grounds and continue in that cycle forever. So from the time these dams were completed, populations of salmon have plummeted more than 90%, which is a huge number. So that's the importance of removing these dams right now.
Yeah, when I was doing some research about the Snake River, I was surprised to see that over 100 species of salmon and steelhead have apparently gone extinct within our rivers over the last few centuries. So it's very surprising to hear that 90%.
Yeah, it's a huge number.
And I'm guessing also that climate change is a contributing factor to making these dams even worse for the salmon in terms of the rivers warming?
Yeah, so when rivers warm up and water is being held still, the salmon are put at risk. And we saw that in 2015 when our rivers reached dangerous temperatures and many, many salmon died. And so that's another reason that we think that this is a really important opportunity for us to begin this conversation and to talk about removing these outdated dams.
So you grew up along the Snake River.
I did.
Do you have any kind of memories you can share with us? And do you have any memories about the salmon in that river?
Oh, yeah. I grew up a stone's throw, legitimately, away from the Snake River, right on the canyon in Twin Falls. And from my backyard, I could look out onto the river. So the Salmon River and I go way back. We have a long-term relationship. And when I was a kid, actually, my family used to vacation near Salmon, Idaho, which is adjacent to the Salmon River. And we would always go to this place called Redfish Lake. And near Redfish Lake, there are, you know, all these little hatcheries that exist. And they do education days for kids, which was like my favorite thing because I loved science and I loved history. And this, like, brought both of them together for me in this really geeky way. So we would go and we'd talk to them and they would explain to me over and over again how the lake was named Redfish Lake for spawning salmon that would visit there every year, and that now the lake doesn't turn red anymore because the salmon aren't returning. And as a little kid, you know, that broke my heart. But also, it was like the first light bulb moment for me where I was like, oh, shoot, salmon are at risk, and we have to do something about that. And I didn't actually realize the importance of these dams until I grew up and started working in conservation. But it's definitely something that had a huge impact on me and my work and continues to drive it. So
I'm surprised, as somebody who was growing up in that community, that the decline of the fish was not spoken about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that we talk about in this community often is hydropower. And that's the thing that everybody talks about, like, oh, there's this clean source of power on the river. And as I've gotten older, I've realized that's not necessarily the truth. There's a lot more to these dams, and they're causing a lot of hardship for salmon, and that hardship for salmon is causing hardship for communities. But yeah, it's not something that we talk about, and I'm trying to change that conversation with you guys here. So thank you for having me again.
So what do you say to the people that are against removing dams because utility costs are high and because they view farmed salmon as a legitimate way to proceed? Like, what harm does farming salmon and potentially like releasing them or having them escape into the wild have on the ecosystem for the salmon?
Wow, that is a big question. No, it's okay. So those wild runs of salmon are dying off, and they're not, there are all these hatchery programs that exist to try to, you know, bring salmon back. But we've seen those fail over and over again. And actually, those fish aren't coming back. They're not bringing up the population numbers at all. And so that science has been disproven over and over again. And for the utility costs, we actually are in a totally different place than we were with renewables when I was a kid, which is really exciting to me. Renewable energy in the Pacific Northwest accounts for 2.5 times what these 4 dams produce. It's a huge number. Like, that's what we currently have in production, like power that's being generated on the regular. So that's really exciting. We have the ability to not use this form of renewable energy, but use a much better wind, solar energy. And I think that that is, you know, those are old stories that we used to tell when we wanted to make dam removal impossible. And we know now that it's possible.
So are there any precedents that, you know, we've seen before the dam, before here on the Snake River? What have we also seen here in the Pacific Northwest in terms of getting these successfully removed?
Yeah, so we have some really exciting examples. And I've actually been watching these, and I would encourage you all to go online and watch these videos that are time-lapse videos of what happens to rivers when dams are removed. And a lot of those are taking place in the Pacific Northwest, which is thrilling to me. So we had one on the Sandy. We had one on the Salmon River. We had a small dam removal on the Rogue. And then the biggest one that I've seen is the one on the Elwha. And there is this amazing video that will totally change your life if you have 5 minutes to sit down and watch what happens when dams are removed from rivers. So, yeah.
Well, someone who's watched the videos and, you know, knows a bit about this, is when you remove a dam, is this a quick process in terms of restoration? Do you see change happen right away?
Yeah. So once the dam is actually physically removed, which is a feat of engineering that's amazing, you do see change happening rapidly. So scientists predicted that salmon would go back and their numbers would return. But what we've seen on the Elwha is that those salmon are returning faster than we ever anticipated. And it's, you know, these precedents are so exciting for us in the conservation community because, you know, here we had scientists saying, yes, restoration will happen if we remove dams. But the numbers are far exceeding what we ever hoped for.
So why should we care about the salmon? You know, why do we want the wild salmon to be returning?
Well, if I could take you all to Idaho and take you to that education class that I went to, you would all know how amazing salmon are. But they are really, really cool. They do extraordinary things. Salmon travel for hundreds of miles to get to the ocean. And that in and of itself is an amazing thing. To be able to go from an environment that is freshwater, live in a freshwater environment, and then move into an environment that is saltwater is impressive and worthy of saving, in my mind, just for that. But they also manage to swim back just based on the sense of smell that they have to where they were born, which is really, really neat. And beyond just being neat, they're delicious, even if you don't eat meat. A lot of animals depend on salmon for their livelihood. So orcas and bears both depend on salmon as primary food sources, among others. And salmon also, you know, as they die when they're spawning, their bodies go back and fertilize the soil and change the future of the areas that they are, which is amazing. They bring all these nutrients back from the ocean into our forests and into our rivers, and that is glorious. Beyond that, there are economic benefits that healthy salmon bring. Healthy salmon runs, I was talking to an economist friend of mine today, actually, before I left the office. He does sustainable economy. And we were talking, and he said, Hillary, it's $1 for $7. And I was like, what does that mean? And he said, for every $1 we spend on salmon restoration, we get $7 in return.
Wow.
Yeah. What a cool number, right? So I told him that he needed to send me those sources and I'll try and get them up on the web for you all. But yeah, really exciting. So
well, talking about the web, where people can find more information about your organization and a lot of organizations that are coming together tomorrow to hold this rally. Well, let's start off with what you guys are doing the rally for. Tomorrow there's going to be a public meeting that's being held by the Army Corps of Engineers where they're going to be taking public comment about these dams. So who should be attending this meeting tomorrow?
Well, I want everyone to attend. If you need help getting there, let me know. We'll find a way. Essentially, this is an opportunity for you, the public, to have a voice on this matter. And what I found is I have this really cute little story of living right on the Salmon River, but everybody has a story. And I hear them all the time. And I'm hearing people say things like, Hillary, I'm so concerned about the environment. What can I do? And this is a really tangible thing that you can do. You can show up. You can make your voice heard. And we have a huge group of people who are going to be there tomorrow. You'll be with people who are like-minded, who want to see this done. And we're walking groups over individually because we won't all fit in the meeting room at once to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to be heard. And that's amazing. This is something that you can do and protect the future for your children. It's really tangible, and I think that's great. The change here is huge.
We said walking over. So where will you all be walking over from? Because I heard that you guys have a rally and an action that will be starting
at 4 p.m.
At 4 p.m. at Spirit of 77.
Yes. So we'll all be meeting at the Spirit of 77 and then walking groups over from there. I will be there with a group of other people. This is not just my organization putting it on. There are many of us. But we'll be listening to people's stories. There'll be videographers there taking stories from people if they want to tell their stories. We'll be signing comment cards, and then we'll be walking in groups to deliver those comment cards. And I think there's a huge number of comments on this, something like 80,000 or something that we'll be delivering. So,
you know, we're just almost out of time here, so I want to make sure that everybody gets all the information they need in order to possibly attend your rally if they are interested tomorrow. So how can people find out more?
So I would encourage people to visit us on Facebook because we'll be hosting a Facebook Live event that will explain more details. You can find us at Pacific Rivers, and you can also find us on the web at pacificrivers.org. You could also email me directly if you need information. My email is Hillary, H-I-L-A-R-Y, at pacificrivers.org. We'd love to see you there tomorrow.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and telling us about your rally tomorrow. So that was Hillary Shahoney, Communications Director for Pacific Rivers. To learn more about their efforts, you can find them at pacificrivers.org. For more information on the rally tomorrow, you can visit their Facebook events page, which you can find by looking for Public Meeting and Rally to Save Wild Salmon. The public meeting being held by the Army Corps of Engineers takes place tomorrow from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Oregon Convention Center.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Audrey Eskright, Al Khan, Joe Lino, and Kanan Schlesinger. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seiwei. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenna Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with guest host Jacqueline Keeler taking an in-depth look at the decision to stop DAPL and the reaction from Standing Rock. At 9 on Political Perspectives, we'll look at the nationwide fight for 15 that workers are waging through the protests and civil disobedience. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, your daily news magazine with Dennis Bernstein. And 11 on The Bike Show, we'll hear from Portland bicycle advocates about how pedal power is keeping the Standing Rock protest powered and connected to media. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. A reminder that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched one-to-one through the end of the year. Thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Night, Kanan.
Night, Jenna.
Night, Wesley.
Night, Wesley.
Night. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to the Report to Monitor White Supremacy. Today we're going in depth into three separate but related stories exploring the appalling degree of racism, both interpersonal and systemic, that floods our public institutions and apparatuses, and what happens when it rears its hideous head in our political leaders and intersects with our streets, often in tragically violent ways. I spoke yesterday with racial justice organizer with Don't Shoot PDX and bureaucracy saboteur Teresa Rayford, who this past Friday facilitated a protest in Oregon State Capitol. In addition to a segment from that interview, in the following clips you'll hear Maria Garcia, an activist and owner of Revolucion Coffee House, and Teresa Rayford alternately speaking in the Capitol building in Salem, and also in front of the Department of Corrections where the protest ended.
Fear for their lives. I don't care if they're in jail. They have lived already 60, 90, 6 months in solitary confinement. We have one of the victims of the lockdown in solitary confinement for 9 months.
Just for speaking out.
Yes, he's at it already 4 months just because he felt like it. This guy, Jaime Rodriguez, was a victim of white supremacists. Jaime is taking pills. He's in solitary confinement. You know what it is? 23 hours lockdown in a space where, you know,